Ahimsicah was the son of the chaplain in King Pasenadi's court. King Pasenadi was a contemporary of the Buddha and a lay follower and a very strong supporter of his. Astrologers noted that Ahimsicah was born under what they called the robber star. Today it's Sirius. We call it the dog star now, but it was called the dog star back then. And so the astrologers thought that Ahimsicah was a great risk of becoming a robber or a criminal. So his parents gave him the name Ahimsicah, which means harmless, in the hopes that that would inspire him to a higher life. And they raised Ahimsicah with a lot of caring, a lot of kindness, and in fact, he grew up strong, intelligent, actually quite athletic, well-behaved, and excelled in his studies. In fact, he excelled so much that when he was old enough, his parents sent him off to the famous Indian university at Takaskila. And there, a very renowned teacher took him in as a student. It was the way the system worked then. You had to find a teacher to take you in, and all his education took place under this teacher. And Ahimsicah was excelled so much in his studies there and served his teacher so faithfully and so humbly that soon he became the teacher's favorite. And his family, his wife, would actually give Ahimsicah meals. Well, the other students were envious of this. And after a while, they got tired of it, and they started plotting to figure out some way to drive a wedge between Ahimsicah and the teacher. And so they started this whispering campaign where they would in chance moments, not a big deal, but sort of quietly when the opportunity arose, would mention to the teacher, you know, Ahimsicah's really disloyal to you. And I thought I heard Ahimsicah sort of figuring out a way that he could, he seems to be doing so well, that he could displace you as a teacher here. And isn't Ahimsicah really quite close to your wife? And on like this. Well, at first the teacher just ignored all the innuendos, but after a while, you know, the poison took root, and the teacher thought that he better figure out some way to get rid of Ahimsicah. So by this time, Ahimsicah had just about finished his studies. So the teacher said to Ahimsicah that the final thing that you must do to honor the teaching, the training, the education you've gotten here, is you must give me a gift. And Ahimsicah said, "Fine, I'd love to do that. What's an appropriate gift?" And his teacher said, "Well, the appropriate gift would for you to give me 1,000 fingers from the right hand." Apparently he thought that if Ahimsicah tried to do this, he'd either get killed or captured or thrown in jail or something. And Ahimsicah said, no, I can't do that. My family never uses violence. But the teacher was very firm and said, you know, if you don't give proper homage to this teaching, that it will bear no fruits. And so eventually Ahimsicah was persuaded of what he had to do. So he retreated into the Jalini Forest, which was near his home province of Kosala. And there was a road that went through the forest and with some hills and some high cliffs on one side. And so he took up residence in some caves up in these cliffs. And so up there, he could see this whole road. So he would... He stayed up there, and then when he saw somebody coming down the road, he would run down and kill them and cut off a finger and take it back up and hang it up in a tree so the birds would peck all the flesh away from it. And then when the birds had cleaned it up, to keep the bones from rotting and falling apart, he strung them onto a necklace, which he wore around his neck. So the news of these gory crimes began to spread. No one knew what his identity was. They didn't know who was doing this. You don't believe the story?
No, I can't wait for it to finish. It's awful.
No one knew who he was, so they took to calling him Angulimala. Okay, so you got it located now? So Anguli means finger, and mala, you know, in a mala beads, means a garland. So they gave him this nickname. He was Angulimala for the finger garland. Well, people stopped traveling in the Jalini forest because of all this, and so to capture people and get the finger from them, he had to travel a little further out to the little villages. And then the villagers began to abandon their homes as sort of like a refugee from a war zone. They left their villages and retreated into the big cities looking for protection. And because of this, King Pasenadi, you know, learned about this, and he gathered a regiment of soldiers to go out and hunt this guy down, whoever he was. And in the process, the Buddha found out about this too. And he sensed that there was actually some goodness in Angulimala. So the Buddha decided he was going to go visit him at the same time. So we'll pick up from there in the Angulimala Sutta, which is Majjhima Nikaya number 86. Angulimala saw the Blessed One coming from afar and thought, "Isn't it amazing? Isn't it astounding? Groups of 10, 20, 30, and 40 men have gone along this road and have fallen into my hands. Yet now, this contemplative comes attacking, as it were, alone and without a companion. I think I'll kill him." And Angulimala took up his sword and shield, buckled on his bow and quiver, and ran with all his might to catch the Buddha, who walked at a normal pace. Yet he could not catch him. And Angulimala thought, "Isn't it amazing? Isn't it astounding? I could catch a swift elephant, a swift horse, a swift chariot, a swift deer, and seize them. But I can't catch this recluse walking at a normal pace. There's something paranormal going on here." So Angulimala stopped and called out, "Stop, recluse, stop." And the Buddha said, "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too." And Angulimala asked, "What does that mean? How have you stopped? How have I not stopped?" And the Buddha said, "Angulimala, once and for all, I have cast off violence towards all living beings. That is how I have stopped. And you are unrestrained towards beings. That is how you have not stopped." And Angulimala thought, there's a lot of sweetness in this next line, if you listen between the lines. And Angulimala thought, "At long last, a revered great seer has come to the forest for my sake. I will renounce evil doing forever." He hurled his sword and weapons into a gaping chasm. He paid homage to the Sublime One's feet, and right then and there requested the going forth. That means he was requesting the Buddha accept him as a disciple. And the Buddha said, "Come, monk." With those simple words, Angulimala became a monk. I kind of suspect that there is more detail in that exchange than has survived in the records, but you get how the events unfolded. Angulimala walked back to Shavasti with the Buddha and began training, and his training included meditation and alms rounds. And as you can imagine, when he went around on his alms round, some people recognized who he was, and they wouldn't give him any food. And some of them started throwing stones and dirt clods at him. And so he would come back to the monastery cut and bleeding. But he continued his daily alms rounds anyway, because that's what was expected of a monk. One day when he was in the alms round, he noticed a woman who was in a very difficult and painful labor, was having trouble delivering this baby, and he was deeply moved by her suffering. And he went back and he told the Buddha about this, and the Buddha said, "You should go help her." So he sent word that he was going to come. And the family set up a sheet in the room where she was lying on a bed. They set up a sheet in the room so he could, and put a chair on the other side so he could sit in the room on the other side of the sheet with his chair and not have a view that would be inappropriate for a monk. And he came and he sat and spoke with her. And in her presence, she became healed. All the difficulties went away, and the child was delivered in good help, in good health. So word of this, a miracle spread, and other women in labor requested that he come. And as more people were healed, attitudes towards him began to change. And he began to get some food on alms rounds, though some people still threw rocks and stones at him. But he bore all these injuries with a peaceful mind and heart. In time, he became a fully enlightened arahat. And eventually he retired off into the forest and lived out the remainder of his life. We don't know much about that, except there are a few verses that have been passed down that he spoke. There are many, many of them. I'll just read two of the verses. "Who once did live in negligence, and then in negligence no more, he illuminates this world like the moon freed from a cloud. He who checks the evil deeds he did by doing wholesome deeds instead, he illuminates this world like a moon freed from the clouds." Today, in countries where Buddhism predominates, most of the children are very, very familiar with the story of Angulimala, as you could imagine. And in Buddhist countries, pregnant women often look upon him as a kind of patron saint whose blessing can ensure a pain-free and easy delivery and bring children joyfully into the world. I imagine that when Angulimala began in training under the Buddha, that he had moments of joy and peace and happiness and serenity, but I truly doubt that it was all sweetness and light. He had renounced violence, but the momentum of his crimes were still with him. Probably the bodily injuries he received from people throwing stones and things at him were small compared to the horrific images that would come up into his mind. I imagine, as a monk, he must have had many moments of great discouragement. When we sit down to meditate, we have moments of joy, moments of serenity, of equanimity, spaciousness, moments of insights that can bring great relief, tastes of genuine freedom. And then the meditation falls apart. The mind flies around the room like a party balloon that got out of your hand before you tied the valve off and just smashes into the wall and then falls to the floor like a total failure. So So we have times when we're filled with graceful serenity, and then times when we're as graceful as a drunken dwarf in heavy boots. I remember when I was training in Thailand once, I wrote in my journal, my mind has checked half of the books out of the Library of Congress and reading all of them at once. This practice can be discouraging. You know, we can think, I just don't think I can do this. I can get moments, I can have glimpses, but I'm no yogi. I just don't have the talent for this. So this evening I wanted to share the story of Angulimala with you in this whole context for a couple of reasons. First of all, in the span of a couple of years, he went from killing 999 people to becoming a fully enlightened arahat. So to me this says, unless you have killed more than 999 people in the last few years, there's a lot of hope for you. There's a lot of hope for all of us. There is nothing essential in us that is a problem. I look at this sutta as a way of saying, you know, look how far you can go astray and still find peaceful, serene awakening. The story for me is a reassurance that distractions are normal and they are not fatal. They are not fatal. There are many stresses in our lives, and I dare say all of us have done bad things. All of us. Sometimes intentionally, oftentimes unintentionally. We stumble over and over. So it's not surprising that disturbing states arise within us. And as you know, this practice is about seeing the truth. It's not about running from it. I love to quote Vivekananda. I don't remember if I said it here the other night. He said once that spiritual growth is just one insult after another. All this stuff rises to the surface. So what this story suggests to me is that, you know, we can really manage it. Probably none of us have gone over to the dark side as far as Angulimala. He awoke nonetheless. And we can as well. So the problem for us is not who we are. It may be who we think we are. It may be who we fear we are. It may be who we hope we aren't. But it's not who we truly are in essence. We don't take refuge each morning in who we think we are. Right? We take refuge in our essential nature, whether we know it and understand it or not. We don't take refuge in how we think things are. We take refuge in the truth of how things are, whether we understand it or not. So that's the first reason I like to share the story. But the second reason, in the main one, and the one I want to go into tonight, is that if you listen carefully to this story, it suggests that there is a relationship between our greatest gifts and our greatest vulnerabilities. Ahimsaka's greatest gift was actually a healer. You know, this capacity that just in his presence, there's something about his energy and who he was that could be extraordinarily soothing and actually help bring children joyfully into the world. And, of course, his greatest vulnerability manifested in killing hundreds of innocent people, taking innocent lives out of this world. So it suggests that our greatest gifts and vulnerabilities may be fraternal twins. Any religion, any spirituality, any philosophy of life that has any depth to it acknowledges that we all have great capacity for serenity, for courage, for compassion, for generosity, for kindness. And it also acknowledges that we have a potential to cause great damage to ourselves and others. All of us do both of them. All of us do both of them. Mm-hmm. Within us is an ahimsaka and an angulimal. This will date me. Also within us is an Anakin Skywalker and a Darth Vader. Right. There's an angel and a demon. There's a Buddha nature and a Mara nature. We can help and we can harm. So this evening I'm going to call our greatest gifts and our greatest weaknesses Dhamma gifts and Dhamma vulnerabilities. Ordinary gifts and vulnerabilities. So ordinary gifts are things like maybe a gift for writing or for painting or poetry or fixing machines or various kinds of talents. And our ordinary vulnerabilities are things like, I don't know, short-tempered or easily discouraged. All the stuff of personality and ordinary psychology. But our Dhamma gifts and Dhamma vulnerabilities go much, much deeper. The Dhamma gifts are particular ways that each of us have for connecting deeply to the core of life. It's just a way that's relatively easy for us to connect to a well-being that we can tap into regardless of what else is going on the surface. And I have come to believe that all of us have one or two Dhamma gifts. They may have been so ignored, you know, in our childhood that we don't believe them. They may be so close to us that we can't see them. They may have been so denied that we become cynical about them, but they're actually there. So, for example, some of you have what I would call the gift of oneness. There is a way that you can feel deeply connected with life as it is. And I see this in a lot of people. And for many people, the place where it manifests most strongly is when they're out in the woods or the fields or out in the wilderness. You know, people with this gift, you know, will get out into the woods and it's like something relaxes. Maybe you feel it. Something relaxes inside. There's something about your armoring, how you hold yourself together, that just melts away. And there's just this kind of ease of being. Some of you have ahimsaka's gift of compassion. You know, you're just drawn to helping those who are suffering or oppressed. And the draw is not to be a do-gooder or to receive some guilt, but there's just a way that you feel a little more alive when your heart is in service of others. Some of you have ahimsaka's gift of serenity. There's a way that in those quiet moments you can just see the perfection of how things are or the perfection of how things are unfolding, which gives you a tremendous capacity to actually be with great suffering without being thrown off balance. You can just be there with it and open to all of it, not shut anything out, and be in balance at the same time. And that serenity is actually quite comforting to those around you. It can be quite healing. Some of you have the gift of lawfulness. Some have the gift of joy. Some have the gift of faith, sort of an underlying confidence. Some of you have the gift of generosity. Some have the gift of call it innocence, just a kind of a natural openness about you. I think there are probably 10 or 15 relatively distinct Dhamma gifts, and they're all related to each other. So all of us know all of them a little bit, but I think each of us has one or two that we have in great abundance. And a gift may not be the same as Ahimsaka's, but they are there. They are there. And if this were the end of the story, then life would be heaven, right? It would be life would be sweet and wonderful, and like Ahimsaka in his later years, life would be groovy, just wonderful. But life is a little more interesting than that. So there's a dark side to each of these gifts, and we all have a dark side. Like Ahimsaka, we are gifted and we are confused. We have flaws, we have weaknesses. So, just consider, life throws up many obstacles. Washed out bridges, fallen trees, potholes. And life just impinges on us. Insults, thoughtless friends, thoughtless unfriends, disappointments, all kinds of things. So when we run into the same obstacle, different of us will respond to those differently. Some people face an obstacle and they get riled. Some people face an obstacle and they're just kind of invigorated to deal with it more. Some people, so for example, take social rejection. Some people, social rejection they just brush it off like water off a duck's back. Other people with social rejection just feel soaked to the core, drown. Under pressure, some people are serene. Other people get frantic. Other people get determined. Others worry about safety. Some people are more prone to melancholy. Others are more prone to anxiety. Some people are always jumping the gun, always getting ahead of things. Other people can't get off the dime. So if you have ever wondered, if you ever caught yourself in a situation and asked, how did I get here again? You know that place? I know this pothole so well. How is it that I fell into this particular one again? You're probably experiencing some of your Dhamma vulnerabilities. If there's only one thing that you take out of this talk tonight, I hope that it is the willingness to just explore the possibility that your greatest vulnerabilities may be related to your greatest gifts, that your greatest strengths may be closely tied to your greatest weaknesses. Okay. For example, if you have the gift of oneness, this sense of so easily feeling connected with life, then if something breaks that connection a little bit, it can really throw you terribly. You feel alone and isolated and cut off from life itself because of your sensitivity to feeling that connection when it's lost. You feel like you're just separated from everything. Sometimes people who have the gift of serenity so easily, when they get thrown off balance, rather than just feeling a little unserene, they get jumpy and their mind starts racing all over the place when they lose that deep connection. If you have the gift of compassion, when you get thrown off balance, it's easy to get frustrated and angry. Passion is, I actually counted the letters, passion is 70% of the word compassion. So that when your compassion is thwarted, it can flare outwards into anger or inwards into grumbling or seething. So to see your Dhamma gifts and your Dhamma vulnerabilities, maybe I'll have you do this now. I'll give you just a couple of questions. I would ask you to just sit back and close your eyes. And then ask yourself, what's the beauty in me? What are my Dhamma gifts? How do I most easily connect with the highest in life? And don't try to figure out an answer, but just take that question, how do I connect most easily, most readily with the depth, the fullness of life, as a way of just directing your awareness a little bit and see what arises. Be careful not to evaluate or to judge or think about it too much. Just see what comes up. And then release that inquiry. And take up a different set of questions. How do I hide my beauty? What are my Dhamma vulnerabilities? What are the quirks and weaknesses that blind me? Judgments are optional and unnecessary. Just see what comes up. What are my weaknesses, my greatest vulnerabilities? I want to pause here before I go on and just see if you have any comments or anything you'd like to share that came up. That's actually a common one. We get so fixated on the one side.
It was like the positive side was determination.
Mm-hmm.
And the vulnerability side was confusion or doubt. So it's kind of
right. The discouragement. Did you want to? No.
dichotomies are interesting and false, they're true and not at the same time.
Yeah. Can you say more?
Just the thing that came to mind is just seemed kind of comical, because my thing is I can be very listening and compassionate and understanding for somebody, but if somebody doesn't understand me, it takes nothing and I'm just like in rage.
Yeah.
And it's those feelings are real and those perceptions are real, but they're also not at the same time. So this whole dichotomy thing is always interesting to have to bring on.
Right. Yeah, they're real in the sense that they're real feelings that are there, but the storyline behind them may be a little warped. You know? My sense is the feelings come up first, and then the mind looks for an excuse to justify them, but oftentimes it's very different. Anything more, or should I rattle on a little bit longer? So another place where our gifts and vulnerabilities show up is in meditation, right? We have lovely moments and unlovely moments. We have moments of seeing things really clearly, and then moments where, hindrances are like a dust storm that just fill us up. Ahimsaka's deep and steadfast devotion to a flawed teacher was a gift in a sense, but it was also his vulnerability. It left him vulnerable to this kind of spell-like twisted logic that he had to kill 1,000 people in order to honor this teacher. So it was that delusion that actually shifted him from his gift of healing to his vulnerability of killing. So our recurring hindrances are oftentimes related to our gifts and our vulnerabilities. Both of them are very powerful. And what can happen with both the gifts and vulnerabilities is our sense of self can kind of shrink wrap around these, where we think, I'm great because I have these wonderful capacities, or I'm terrible because of this. Very easy to identify with either pole. So I want to bring this one other element into all of this. This tendency that we all have to take things personally is it's actually the core of all hindrances. If there's not a sense of self there, then there's just a bunch of just a flow of phenomena. Right? So if you have a hindrance that comes up, you can six-R the hindrance. But you can also look for where the sense of self is, and if you can find that, and I'll talk more about this other night, you can 6R that. Because if there's no self there, then there are no hindrances. Right? They're just phenomena. In Buddhism, this is called samadhi. Samadhi, which is usually translated as wise view. Wise view is actually seeing things impersonally. Including right down to our greatest gifts and our greatest vulnerabilities. So another reason I like to share the Angulimala story in it is it has this incredibly clear image of wise view, of not taking things personally. Angulimala would come back from his alms rounds, cut and bleeding with all this stuff thrown at him. I could imagine there were probably verbal insults. Who knows? There could be all kinds of stuff. And his response to all that was, It's like, he understood all the stuff he had done in the past and that people were just responding to that. So, big surprise. Big surprise. He didn't take it personally. So that he actually remained quite serene in the face of all this. So, which raises an interesting question, as we meditate or as we go through our day in the outside world and distractions come along, They may not be as violent as the kitchen utensils they were throwing at Gulimala, but we can feel them anyway. And the question is, do we take them personally? When do we take them personally? And when do we have the capacity to actually step away from them and not take them personally? Like, I think one place where most of us cannot take those personally is if, a three-year-old comes over running up at you and hits you because you picked up his truck, you know, and he's furious. And, you know, do you take that personally? Probably not. But in a lot of other places, we really do. So, wise view is simply a way of viewing everything as impersonal. Wise view, it's not a beloved philosophy. It's not a philosophical stance. It's not a Buddhist metaphysics. It's not an idea. It's not a doctrine. It's not a set of ideas. It is just the ability to see things impersonally. Wise view is a way of taking dispassionate interest in whatever arises. So I want to give you another story about a murderer that kind of illustrates this. Me. It's about me. It was the fifth day of a 10-day meditation. And I was sitting in the Dhamma Hall at Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, with probably 125, 130 other people. And I was sitting there, and it was very serene and very peaceful. And out of this peacefulness, this image arose in my mind of a jagged knife that I was pushing into my wife's back. That was the image that showed up there. And I will tell you, I did not greet this image with dispassionate interest. I did not greet it with wise view. I freaked out. It's like, yeah, is there some sort of homicidal tendency inside me that I've missed? You know, am I in Gulimala, you know, pretending to be a Ahimsaka? What's going on here? So what I did was, what you can imagine, is I forced all my attention back onto the breath, which is the practice I was doing then, and with sort of white-knuckled intensity, just hung on to the breath as tightly as I could until somebody mercifully rang the gong to indicate the end of the meditation period. And then when the next meditation period came around, I sat down, and as I began, I kind of coached myself. I said, don't let an image of me stabbing Erica in the bath arise in my mind. Didn't work very well. And so finally I got it. Not through any great wisdom, but as I say, most of this can be from futility. I got it that there's no way I can run from my mind. You know, everywhere I go, it tends to follow me around. And so I realized, you know, if there's some homicidal tendency inside me, I better get to know it, you know. If there's, if I am in a Gulimala in there someplace, it'd be much better off not fighting it off, but letting myself see it so it doesn't catch me by surprise at, some unsuspecting moment. So despite all my anxiety about it, I actually turned towards it. And it wasn't because I thought this was a wonderful thing to do, but because I didn't see I had any other choice. And so I turned towards it, and it's just understanding that it's probably not going to go away if I push it away, and I just opened up to it. I just stopped fighting the image at all and just kind of let it come over me and just to see what it would tell me. And you know what happened? almost immediately. Within a couple of minutes, it was like just a mist in the sun. It was just gone. And I had to struggle a little bit to remember that I had been upset about something. But it was just gone. And there was my body just softened, and I remember smiling. And then in that greater spaciousness, I finally saw what had been going on. I realized that what had happened was that, true confession time here, that I've had this image that I secretly, I didn't want to acknowledge it myself, that I always hung on to, of being a good boy. You know, I was raised, I was supposed to be a good boy. So I was hanging on to this self-image of me being a good boy in much more sophisticated adult terms, but that was just it. No, I had to be a good boy. And when that image rose up, the good boy in me just freaked out. And once the fear got going, it was just self-perpetuating. It was just run. But once I let go of being a good boy, you know, maybe there is this murder or something inside me. I let go of the image of a good boy. Well, his evil twin just evaporated at the same time. And I think about that now because that was over 40 years ago. And I can, you know, imagine where my life would be now if I had been fighting that image, you know, for all those decades, trying to keep that at bay because I was afraid to open up to it. You know, the fear and the resentment, all that stuff would have become this really solid lump that I was kind of hold off at arm's distance. So I offer this as an example of wise view in action. It is not always dressed up in flowers and pretty scenery. And the way that wise view is put into practice is actually just seeing, just recognizing what's going on and not analyzing why it's there. There's hypnosis is actually quite interesting in this regard. If you take somebody and hypnotize them, and most of us, particularly meditators, are actually quite can go into hypnotic trances fairly quickly. You can hypnotize somebody and give them a post-hypnotic suggestion that something like, every time I say the word button, every time somebody says the word button, that you'll walk to the window. It's a very simple thing. And then you come out of the hypnotic trance and you don't remember what the suggestion was, and you're sitting there and the hypnotist says, you know, I think I lost the button. And what happens is we get up and we walk to the window. Now, that's pretty bizarre behavior. And so what happens inside is you don't just get up and walk to the window. You say, oh, it's getting stuffy in here. You know, or, oh, you know, I think somebody's calling my name. Or, you know, I need to open this up to see if, go over there and see if this person has actually arrived. The mind very quickly will contrive these spurious reasons for it. So that's one of the reasons meditation say, you know, that don't pay that much attention to the storylines. Pay attention to the feeling. Recognize what's going on. Release it. Right? Relax the tension in it. Smile. Go back to sending out metta. And as you do that, as this gets deeper and deeper, you begin to see these things coming up as being less and less personal. So one of the most effective ways of cultivating wise view is actually the six R's. Because you're not trying to get rid of anything. You're letting it be there so you can see the whole thing, but letting the tension go. And as that goes away, as the tension goes away, our identification with it tends to go away as well. So, one last thought, then I'm interested in your thoughts about all this. My little notes here, I put a note down that says non-dual. And this is about the non-dual nature of all of this. It's very easy to think of Ahimsaka and Gulimala as two different entities that serially inhabited this one body. It's, but the Buddha didn't see it that way. What was really going on there was there was one person, one being there, but was exposed to different causes and conditions. So under some circumstances, what gets triggered, what the response that comes out is what was called Ahimsaka. In other situations, there was an Gulimala, but it was actually the same person. They weren't separate angels and demons. Luke Skywalker, Anakin Skywalker, and Darth Vader. Got to remember the modern mythology here. So if you feel assaulted by hindrances and you just want a way to, just want to get away from them, the fastest, most effective way to deal with them wisely is to see the hindrance as nirvana, as a mask, as a covering, to see the hindrance as just a mask that may be disguising this deeper truth. Don't get involved in the storyline. Just relax, see what's beneath the surface. The Buddha never said that we have Anakin Skywalker and Darth Vader, but he did counsel us to cultivate wise view, seeing things impersonally. We humans are creatures who stood up on our hind legs and supported and exposed the softness of our belly to the world, our vulnerabilities. It's just how we walk into the world. And so our sensitivities will get hit and get triggered. And if we'll get hit, our sensitivities, yeah, we'll get triggered. We have just almost physiologically, we've chose to expose those. And so if we greet those vulnerabilities with fear and rejection, you know, and try to push them away, that actually will not change the present moment at all. But what it does do is it sets up a conditioning for more fear and rejection in the future. Okay. But if we treat the hindrances, the sensitivities, the vulnerabilities with kindness and with openness, then the gifted part of it comes to the surface and they become a blessing. They become a blessing.
Why does that happen?
Mm-hmm. Why does which happen?
Why does not expensing them fully create or resisting them create more karma for them to come back to the future?
Because of tension. When you're resisting, when you're pushing down, it puts more tension into the system, and tension is the nitty gritty of karma.
But physiologically, doesn't it create neuron paths and synapse connections and neuromuscular connections?
Right. That's the neurophysiology of karma. Yeah, so we know much more about the neurophysiological correlates of it. But basically, it's you've created a tension in your system and you're walking around with it. And that leaves your system vulnerable, if for no other reason than just the rigidity of it.
So could I say, then we're wiring ourselves for it?
Yes. You know, what we know about the malleability of the human brain is that we're always rewiring ourselves. And so if there's fear and rejection that's not relaxed, it gets wired in.
So we're rewiring unwholesome states.
Yes. And
Repeatedly.
And I think what happens with the six R's, the reason we stress them so much and repeated them so much, is they actually get wired in. It becomes over time, it becomes an instinctual response, even almost a conscious one, of something comes up, and rather than or running like that, it's like, oh, okay, there's just that also. And when the practice goes very deep, it starts happening unconsciously or preconsciously almost. You start samsaring even before you become conscious of what's there. Okay, great question. The answer is no. I didn't know we were going to go into this. But it's actually looking at what karma is. And so just being born in a body, there's a certain amount of stuff that comes with it. We're born in bodies that are designed to self-destruct. And so, right, they just last a certain amount of time and they wear out. So to keep them from being destroyed randomly just by being unmindful, we have pain. You know, if you do something, hurt it. So it's actually just a karma that comes from being in a body. So, but it's to make the distinction between pain as sensation and suffering. The sensation itself, you know, being in a body, there are times that it's going to hurt. But whether we suffer or not depends on whether or not we resist it or fight it.
For instance,
but you're not to blame.
I have lots of fun with hot flashes.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like a hot flash is going to come on and I'll take...
Today's been one big long one. So it's actually the resistance that causes the suffering. The Buddha didn't say we could avoid pain, but he said we can get free of suffering. And so if the hot flashes come and you just relax into it, there still will be lots of sensations. And maybe tomorrow we'll look at dependent origination, you know. So there's the exposure and then there's an unpleasant feeling. That we may not have control over. But what we do with that, we begin to have control over. We try to push the unpleasant feeling away, then things begin to lock up in suffering. If we just let it go through, it doesn't. My understanding is that the amount of medication it takes to relieve pain goes up with age, on average. You may know this more about this than I do, Judy. But they say, you know, with an older person, it may take a certain dosage. With a younger person, half that amount of dosage. With a little baby, they may not need anything at all because you have to learn to be frightened, have to be scared and want to push it away in order for there to be actual suffering. Otherwise, there's just strong sensation. In Buddha's map, the clearest example that I can think of that is when you were a kid and had a loose tooth, and it creates this very sharp sensation. And so what do you do with it? Well, I sit there with my tongue and I wiggle it, you know. And so it creates a sharp sensation, but it's not really suffering because I'm actually curious and because I interpret it as a sign that, you know, the tooth fairy is going to come and there's all these, you know, wonderful things that are going to happen. But if I was frightened of that sensation, then I would be in a hell space because, you know, it's right inside me.
Yeah, one of the things that happens as people get older is that they acquire tension that they're really unconscious of. I run across this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that instead of walking around with a lot of tension in their body, they don't know it until it starts to produce pain. So they haven't had the option of bringing it down before it starts creating pain.
Right.
I've seen that a lot. It's
yeah. Very common. Well, yeah, and and what happens is it usually has to get worse before it gets better. Mm-hmm. So, example that I always think of is if you've ever run through the airport with a suitcase in your hand, you know, and then it goes numb, right? And you don't actually feel anything until you try to release it, and then all the pain comes in. But the one thing I found out about that is that you know, one of the tricks, if you do that and the hand is numb, is that rather than release it slowly, you can just, you know, you can actually release a lot of it at once. But what most of us do is we're frightened, so we go very slowly, so we sort of drag the pain out for a long period of time. So what happens to, you know, with people who, you know, in whatever the situation, they don't have that fear, they don't have the resistance to it, and they actually, the sensation will actually release more quickly because they aren't fighting it. Other thoughts or comments? Yeah.
Two sides of the same coin. It did occur to me that one of my gifts, as I see it, is that I can be very generous and very caring and step in if I see someone needs help. You can, you know, even if we'll give them financial help, which we can't necessarily do, but I go over and above, beyond, taking care of them, bringing them things, just on every level taking care of them. And then it goes to a point, goes to a point, goes to a point. And then finally I'm beginning to realize that there's some resentment there and I'm not, there's no return on that at all. There's not an acknowledgement, like, as I would have expected or thought, you know, it might come and that sort of thing. And it ends up being a real vulnerability because then I'm taking it personally.
Yes.
And and I was going to say, it even occurred to me that my actions were wrong motivation to begin with. Or maybe they were right motivation and they became wrong motivation. Or they, you know, were transformed en route or something like that.
Well, I think that's a great example because let's just assume, because I think it's probably true, that it really is a gift. And that, but that something else happens on top of it. As I was talking about last night, is rarely we do anything for one motivation. So, most often we treat other people the way we would like to be treated. You know, I think it's the downside of the golden rule. You know, treat other people as you would have them treat. Well, actually, if you want to be kind to people, you treat them the way they want to be treated. It may be very different than you. So, but so we sort of unconsciously treat people expecting it, you know, to come back. And so, you know, the vulnerability there is not seeing that there's this other motive, you know, that you want some caretaking to, that the giving may be quite genuine, and there also may be some giving that has an expectation of something in return. Thich Nhat Hanh had this suggestion, which is a wonderful practice, of experimenting with giving in ways that the gift cannot be traced back to you, because then you get the feeling of the pure giving, and see what that's like. And there can be a great joy in it, and even a kind of it's almost like a secret pleasure, you know, you know, in the giving of it. But it helps to tease, you know, the two of those apart. Thank you for that. That's one of my gifts is actually, you know, really caring and tuning into people, and people who work from the heart side of things. This is actually a larger thing. Most people who are heart centered have a little more trouble with time boundaries. Right? And my example of it is that there was a woman in my church who sent me this email and said, why do we always call it a worship service? Why don't we just call it a meeting? And why is all this religious language? Why do we have to call it a sanctuary? It's a meeting hall. And I was in the liberal progressive ministry, so we had a whole range of people, and including atheists and pagans, etc. And so I was feeling a little grumpy, but I started to send a note back, and I just paused for a minute, and I just took her question at face value. And I sent back to her, and I said, you know, we value being open, and we have... We meet on Sunday morning, and we sing songs and listen to a sermon. For 99.99% of the world, that sounds like a church service. And so if we really want to be open to the outside world, we need to use language they're familiar with. Otherwise, we have to give them a glossary when they walk in the door, which is not familiar. So we had that little exchange. And then after service the next Sunday, I was really tired, and I wanted to get home early. And I was just about to leave, and she stuck her head in the door. And she said, thank you, that was really great. You know, I really appreciate it. And I said, well, come in, you know. And so she came in, and she sat down, and we talked for about 5 minutes and left. And I looked up, and there was an hour and 15 minutes had gone by, you know. And so there are my time boundaries. But I tell you, if I had to do it over again, I'd do the same thing. So some of it is actually just appreciating. It's this little different angle on, but appreciating that, you know, there are some vulnerabilities in all of these, and looking deeply to, so that you just do it a little more consciously. You know? So if there's a vulnerability of you giving so much that at some point there's a little expectation of something coming back, you know, as you become more sensitive to that, you can see that expectation coming back, and then adjust your behavior, you know, accordingly, as opposed to just sort of blindly getting caught in that, and then it's falling into the same pothole over and over again. Thank you.
Sometimes it's better to try different things than to explore why something is not working or it is the way it's wired.
Yep. Well, that's what I say. I'm a great fan of empirical trials, to just actually try things out, you know, and see what happens.
So okay. I had a question about, you mentioned dualism and non-dualism.
Yes.
So do you believe that, in your opinion, this practice leads to practitioners becoming, in a sense, non-dual?
Yes. Yeah, that I think polarities and dualities are intellectual phenomena.
Well, we have to use them in speech.
Yeah, speech tends to be dualistic. It's the nature of the language, and there are, oh my goodness. Okay. I'll see if I can do this quickly. I think there's actually two different kinds of realities. There is what we'd call relative reality, which is what we live in most of the time, and then there's absolute reality. And absolute reality is what you touch into more and more deeply into the pure awareness. And when you get into the pure awareness, you see, for example, judgments, good, bad, is a really bizarre phenomena. When you judge something, you take part of a reality and you turn it into a scale, and then you take this thing and you compare it to it. And when you think about it, it's kind of a bizarre process. And so as the mind-heart gets quieter and more open and more fluid, those dualities... It's not like they disappear, but they're seen as kind of illusionary. And because the reality is that whether you like it or not, this thing happened, you know. And not liking it doesn't change it one bit. Reality doesn't really care what our opinions are. It just is. And so that's a non-dual. But at the same time, if we're committed to living in the world, and would like a world that is more peaceful and fair, that there are times when there are elections where you vote one way or another. I mean, there's times where we just make those judgments. We have to make those calls. But it's just healthier if we just understand that it's in surface of a relative reality, not an ultimate reality.
So in understanding that, in what's called the most absolute terms that you can understand it in, do you think that that can be attained through intellectual process, through reading about how it happens, or does it have to be a gestalt where there's actually, like what we're doing, a training that transforms, like, the habitual level of understanding or the conditioned level of understanding to essentially decondition and to be able to perceive a more ultimate reality? So, training or learning?
Yes.
Both.
There are, people who are very ripe, and there's just, you know, and there's a stimulus, which, that's what it is. Because the insights that arise, and, you know, kind of experience this in meditation, when a deep insight arises, oftentimes it's you don't experience it as something new. It's, how did I forget that? You know, it's a kind of re-remembering. I think what we're doing in this meditation is that we are training the body, mind, the psycho-spiritual system to be a little more receptive to the deeper reality of how things are. I don't think it can be trained. The actual, that happens spontaneously, but we can make ourselves much more receptive to it.
But also part of it is actually experiencing the world in a non-dual,
right,
fashion as well.
Right. Yeah, so it's what, you know, so somebody may read a book, you know, and wake up, but it's because they'd experience in something. It's not because of the words there. Mm-hmm. And so for most people, you know, reading can only take you so far, and it needs something a little more dynamic, but that's possible too.
I mean, it can give you the feel of it, like Athanasius' poetry, right, and all the sacred poetry,
yeah,
does give, communicates that sense of non-dual,
mm-hmm,
in many cases very potently.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you get trained yourself immediately to be able to have those.
Right, right,
right.
Thank you. Other comments? By the way, it was really good to see you all today and to see how your meditation is coming along. It's one thing I didn't talk about that I think might be helpful. Some of you know this, but it's a demonstration of wise effort. It's a tricky one to get a hold of, but there's a real easy demonstration of it. If we could take just a moment to do that. So what I would invite you to do is to put your awareness in your feet. Put your awareness into your feet. And then put your awareness into your hands. And then put your awareness into the realm of sounds. And then put your awareness into the realm of hot and cold. Okay. So that's the demonstration. What you'll see there, for example, is I experienced when I thought, well, going into the world of sound, all of a sudden I started hearing the birds and the fan, right, that hadn't been in my awareness before. Right? The heat, I don't know. That may have been background in your awareness all the time. How many of you were aware of your feet before I invited you to? Right? So your feet were there. So we could do a whole lot of things about what that means about awareness, but the important question is, how much energy did it take for you to shift your awareness from one object to another? Yeah, just about zero. Yeah. That's wise effort. That's wise effort. And what this practice is actually moving towards, the Buddha talked, you know, the Eightfold Path, there were three of those that he said were primary. There was wise view, wise effort, and wise mindfulness, sati, awareness. And wise effort, to do this meditation, it takes a lot of effort, you know, to remember, to keep coming back, etc. But it doesn't take a lot of energy. And if you do, it just gets harder. So when you're sitting, just pay attention, you know, periodically to how much energy you're putting into the effort.
And how can you motivate that?
Pardon?
And how does one motivate that amount of energy that you put in? What does it mean to say that you put a lot of energy into it?
Well, just notice it. Just notice it. So put a whole lot of energy into noticing your right hand.
I'm not sure what that would even mean.
Oh, come on. Yes, you do. So what you do is you focus all your attention in there.
Okay.
Yeah. So really, really get in there and block everything else out. It's just that it's a kind of a pushing, and what we're doing, and basically where it goes to wise mindfulness, wise awareness, is that wide open field, and any time you push the awareness, it will focus in, which can be useful temporarily sometimes, but not for long.
Yes, I believe that. Your descriptions of that, which I think are really true, are that there's a lightness of being when you're not putting a lot of effort and energy
right.
into all of the
right.
perceptions.
Yeah. And of course, the difficulty is in the beginning when you get that lightness of being, the mind can tend to drift because you're used to having a lot of pressure behind it. But as you get more used to it and as the awareness gets stronger and stronger on its own, then you can actually be there with very little effort. And since it takes a little more push in the beginning and you get some success, you're going to think, oh, it's because I'm pushing and you push harder, when actually you need to back off some.
That's very subtle because that's counterintuitive with a lot of other tasks.
Yeah. Well, and what I would go back to again is just experiment with it. You know? Try put a little more energy in, a little bit less. And if there's too little energy in there, then the mind will dull out. So it's always find that balance point. But the balance point is a very relaxed one. Okay, I have one final little tiny quote for you, but I wanted to see if there's any more comments. Questions?
So you brought up two factors, wise effort and harmonious energy. Yeah.
Wise effort, it's view, effort, and sati.
Right, but you brought up the word energy.
Oh, did I say that? What I meant was wise effort.
Effort.
Yeah, wise effort.
Okay.
Which is effort without push, without energy behind it. Yeah, okay. Thanks for correcting me.
Well, no, I'm not correcting. I just wanted to understand. Yeah.
No, if I said it wrong, I'm glad to have it clear.
I think I heard it wrong.
Okay.
What are those two things, right? Effort, view?
It's view, wise view, which is seeing things impersonally. And wise view is actually a way of viewing. It's not a particular view. It's just a way of viewing things impersonally. And then wise effort, which is the effort without push. And then there's wise mindfulness, which I'm tending to just call it awareness now because mindfulness has kind of taken on a life of its own. And I typed into Google the other day in a half a second, there were 24 million hits. So, where I want to leave you is with where our sensitivities are and how they can create this vulnerability where we can be hurt and where we can sort of fight against them, or we can greet them with a lot of kindness. And that has a huge impact. So this is from Carlos Castaneda. The teachings of Don Juan. He writes, "Does this path have a heart? If it does, the path is good. If it doesn't, it is of no use. Both paths lead nowhere, but one has a heart and the other doesn't. One makes for a joyful journey as long as you follow it. You are one with it. The other will make you curse your life. The one makes you strong. The other weakens you." So if we can. Thank you all for the gift of your practice and for bringing your vulnerabilities and sensitivities and good heart and wisdom and clarity, all of it with you. Knowing that we all feel the effect of one another. And then taking a moment and having us as a sangha, as a collective, sending out through all those connections out through the rest of the world. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings trust their gifts and their beauty. May all beings have wisdom in viewing their vulnerabilities. May all beings know freedom. May it be so.